Welcome back to Consuming the Craft Podcast. With me today, Charles Stanley. You wear a lot of hats at Oak and Grist Distillery out in Black Mountain, so I don't want to say that you're just a distiller, salesperson, plumber, mechanic.
The answer would be yes to all of those.
Yeah, I know. So it's you graduated from our program here at AB Tech, and you did your internship there, I believe, as well.
I did my internship there as well. So yeah.
you did a year and a half interview basically with them, and you decided that they were going to keep you on, and now you've been there for how many years?
Coming up on 3.5 years.
Nice.
At Oak and Grist. So I did my internship. It was COVID times, and so
it was a mess.
Traditionally, that would be done in the summer between first and second year. That's when COVID hit, and I had very few options.
Everyone had very few options at the time.
So I ended up doing this internship my second semester of second year.
Yep.
Which timing-wise was maybe less than ideal because I was trying to do my capstone at the same time.
I remember this.
And working full-time at Oak and Grist.
So it was after this, remind me, we can go back and look for your capstone. We can try some of that as well.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So a little bit chaotic, but really great actually on both ends. It gave me a really good foundation into what they were doing. It was a two-way interview, right? I needed to see what they were doing. They needed to see what I was
doing. You wanted to, first of all, find a good fit for you because it's not like you haven't been in the beverage industry before. You were a wine rep for 10 years.
Yeah, I was in the wine business for 10 years.
Yeah.
Ran a couple of wine shops as a buyer, did wholesale work, and then ultimately was an import portfolio manager.
Yeah. So it's not your debut in the beverage industry by any stretch. And before that, of course, you've always consumed in moderation and was very respectable of the product. So,
of course,
now you are distilling. You're doing sales for Oak and Grist. And one of the things that we had talked about a little bit before, and I was like, no, we got to record. You guys have always been grain to glass, and
correct,
you make the base for your gin. Now, I don't know. It's not like I'm trying to call anybody out, but I know a lot of people are making a redistilled gin. They're buying neutral spirits and they're making their gin out of that base, which is what a lot of gins are, to be quite honest, on the shelf. You guys are actually distilling your base and then making your gin from that.
That's correct. Yeah. So a little background on OG, founded by William Goldberg, who is my boss. Best boss I've ever had, and I'm not saying that because he's going to listen to this. He probably won't, but he's a really fantastic guy to work for and work with. But we were both Warren Wilson guys. And so his philosophy had been a cheesemaker prior to starting this distillery. And his philosophy was really create as much of a value-added agricultural product that was Carolinian in representation. And so fully grain to glass from the beginning, he didn't want to be buying spirits made by anyone else. Of which there's nothing wrong with
No.
As long as you've got a business license and a checkbook that's big enough, you can buy some really fantastic things made by other people and launch your brand. And arguably, an accountant will tell you that is a much more financially
stable and a great idea,
wise way to start a business.
One of the things that a lot of, some of these craft distillers, even some of the ones recently that have been like bought out by other places, they'll start by buying some of this stuff and then slowly incorporate their product over time as the revenue keeps coming in. And that's the model we're talking about here when we teach. I mean, it's a sustainable like model for making sure income coming in, but him hitting the road that quickly, that fast. And I remember meeting Will, a long time ago when he was just opening, it was, yeah, it was staggering the amount of work that he was trying to do all by himself right away.
He ran it for two years, every single thing top to bottom by himself, which I have a lot of respect for because he has done every single hard, dirty, nasty job.
Yeah.
And he has put his own blood, sweat, and tears into it. And there's no question of like, well, just I need this done. Kind of thing. He's done it himself.
He's done it himself for 2 years straight.
But being fully grain to glass, there's some challenges if you want to make whiskey in that your revenue doesn't come in for years off of that whiskey as you barrel it. So in doing so, kind of talking about what you mentioned with the gin, we make a very old style of gin, Genever, which is finally getting recognized in the U.S. a little bit.
People are getting educated about it. It predates gin. I mean, it really does.
It was Europe's first style of gin production. Originally, they were not making it with vodka. Vodka was not really around yet in the early 1500s.
They didn't have the techniques to even make something that strong.
Right. Column stills didn't come around until the 1820s.
Yep.
1824, I think. So 200 years ago.
Yeah.
So they were taking white malt whiskey, unaged malt whiskey, new make spirit, and redistilling it with botanicals to create Geneva-style gin.
So in my heart of hearts, it'd be like, that stuff coming off the still was undrinkable. We have to put this stuff in there to make it.
I think, honestly, that's probably what it was. Yeah. Like, our distilling techniques and understanding of the science behind it are substantially better.
Well, even just the fermentation technique. Like, we understand yeast.
Right.
You know, and so...
We're not relying on spontaneous fermentation.
Correct.
Or the 10 millionth generation of repropagated yeast, which is getting pretty far out there.
Yeah.
But that allowed us to have this grain to glass model from the very beginning, and we could take some of our new make spirit production, redistill it into gin, and then also be laying whiskey down at the same time. And I think it's really fantastic. It's been a little bit of an uphill battle in some ways, because there's not the public knowledge and understanding of what this spirit is. So it's more work on our side.
It's education, 100%.
But in doing so, we also work in a spirit category with our style of gin that isn't cluttered with every single craft distillery in the world being like, I can buy IBC totes of vodka for very little money.
We can even buy redistill
or
gin.
It, or just buy it straight up.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, in our tasting room, when we have folks come in, because we have a lot of local support, which is fantastic, but being in Asheville, we also have a ton of tourism.
Yep.
So people come in, ask what we're doing. They're curious. We say, well, we make whiskey and we make Geneva style gin. And sometimes you'll see people just shake their heads and go, no, 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 I don't do gin. And it's probably because they had really bad gin a long time ago and they don't like that very strong juniper profile.
Correct.
And so I always tell people, you know what? That's totally fine if you don't like it. I take no offense to that.
No.
Give it a shot on your tasting flight, though, because it is much more of a whiskey drinker's gin. There's a roundness and a fattiness on that profile from that grain.
You get more of the grain maltiness. Base, 100%.
And as far as Geneva gins go, there are many different styles that are still being produced in Europe, varying levels of maltfine or like... a distilled malt base versus vodka being blended into it. And those are all completely legal, just categorized differently. Ours is 100% maltfine or a malt whiskey base.
Yeah.
So you really get a beautiful malt profile. The other thing I'll tell people is if you're not into gin because juniper is kind of polarizing for you, stylistically, Geneva gins have a much lower juniper content load. So I always say, along with our other botanicals, it's almost like a tea-like profile in that the juniper is perceivable for sure, but it's in concert with the other botanicals rather than being that leading profile that you're like, I've really got to pull this back.
Yeah, like a redistilled gin that's designed to be mixed with tonic.
Exactly.
Yeah. No.
And it's great on its own. I'm happy to talk about our botanicals if you want to.
I mean,
it's not a secret.
Okay.
Juniper, by law, if we put gin on a label, the TTB and federal government says juniper has to be the largest quantity of botanicals by weight, of which it is.
Yep.
But we don't crush our whole juniper berries. We leave them whole.
Which would mute some of the juniper. Mm-hmm.
Which mutes some of that intensity. We use angelica and orris roots.
Okay. Pretty, a little earthiness there.
Mm-hmm, a little earthiness, but pretty classic in gin production as bittering agents.
Yep.
Coriander, lemon verbena, chamomile, wild sumac, and carrots.
Carrots, interesting.
Mm-hmm. And the carrots give a really nice, round, earthy sweetness. It doesn't come off as confected.
Mm-hmm.
But another cool thing about those carrots being in this gin is it has a similar profile in some ways to agave-based spirits.
Okay.
Out of that
sure.
That sweeter root vegetable element. So you can really stretch your legs with the style of gin. We make really fantastic margaritas or gin sours with it.
Mm.
And if you want to take it as a tequila substitution, you really can.
You could.
And
it's
fantastic.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which when I first heard that, I thought, you know, you're going to make a gin margarita. Like, is the sky red? And, you know, like this doesn't make sense to me on the surface, but it's delicious.
I imagine a Bloody Mary would work.
bloodies are great.
Yeah.
Some nice savory character in there.
So you're blending that. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
And we are able to source a number of our botanicals from small farms here in Western North Carolina.
Amazing.
So our Angelica root, our lemon verbena, and our chamomile all come from local farms here in Western North Carolina, which is great for us to invest in that agriculture as well.
So it's dried materials?
All dried.
All dried.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the carrots, I'm assuming.
Except for the carrots, yeah.
Okay.
We'll buy fresh carrots.
Yeah. Okay. And then you have to peel the carrots?
Peel and do a rough chop. So it's pretty simple.
Okay.
And for our batch sizes, it's not really a crazy amount of carrots.
No. But it's still another addition to the, and I don't need to know any more about your process from there because that's not necessarily fair. But that being said, it's a unique ingredient. I heard of people using parsnips. I've heard of recently people adding oats.
As a creamy botanical texture.
Yeah. And, yeah. Well, with that earthiness, kind of a substitution for the Angelica or the some of those other kind of savory, earthy things that pair well with some of the woody, piney flavors coming out of the juniper.
Yeah. And our philosophy on these gin botanicals, of which they've always been the same since our inception, some of the quantities have changed as we've refined kind of what we were looking for to produce. They're all things that grow naturally in Western North Carolina.
Okay.
So I absolutely love lime direction gins, especially kind of Southeast Asian styles where it's kefir lime leaf and elements like that. It's a really fun, fresh flavor pop. And we certainly could have done that if we wished to, but when you're flavoring gin with botanicals, you have the opportunity to give that spirit a sense of place, a terroir to where it is being produced.
Yeah.
And so in choosing botanicals that are all native or naturally growing in Western North Carolina, we can really give it a sense of Southern Appalachia and Western North Carolina.
Well, and you're using the malt wine base too. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have this neutral grain or neutral whatever base material it's made from.
Right.
As kind of the palate. I mean, you have to be conscious about the flavors of the barley that's going into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that barley is being complemented by the botanical selection that has been, added to it. I think that's, I'm excited. I've always liked your gin because it was unique. I've always liked Genever's because truth be told, I like whiskey. I don't know if anybody out there knows that, but they probably know that by now.
It's the whiskey drinker's gin.
And I like single malts, which is another product that you guys make. So you started laying down single malts. You're learning about the process. You're learning about the facility. And you've been making single malt whiskeys since basically the inception of the place as well. And now you've got a couple different offerings.
We do,
With finishes. I believe there's a rum finish.
Correct.
What made you pick rum as one of the finishes?
Truth be told, I took a vacation to the Outer Banks right when I finished my internship before I started full time as an actual payroll employee at Oak and Grist, and called up. I was near Kill Devil Hills Rum or Outer Banks Distilling Company.
Yeah.
And called those guys up and said, hey, I'm in the industry. I'd love to come check out what you guys are doing. They brought me in, had a great day talking with them, had a couple of cocktails and started shooting around some ideas. We're about the two farthest away distilleries in the state of North Carolina,
honestly,
geographically.
Yeah, it's like 11 hours to get there.
Yeah, it's really far away in the same state.
Yeah.
And we had never done any barrel finishes. And my girlfriend at the time, after we finished that meeting, said, do you have any authority to speak about what you just did? And I said, no, but I'm more of a forgiveness than permission guy. I was like, I've spent a career in sales. And if I see an opportunity, I'm going to open that door.
Sure,
we can figure the details out on the back end if necessary.
Yeah.
So we did a barrel exchange program with those guys and we sent them some used single malt barrels that we had our whiskey in. And they returned some rum barrels. And so that was kind of our first foray into barrel finishing, which for a small distillery like we are, it's a really great opportunity to not blow up our fermentation and brew side, keep all of our distillations the same, have our spirit character in our whiskey, and then create a completely new product.
With the base material,
with just a different type of barrel. So we filled a couple And it was sort of like, let's see a proof of concept here.
Before see if it works. 100%. That's a big investment to fill a barrel.
Yeah. I mean, it's a financial risk on our side. If 100%. It went sideways, that is tens of thousands of dollars of whiskey at retail price for us that would not be sellable.
Which is good because you weren't even an employee at the time.
Right.
It's not even your fault.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, it was by the time I got back.
By the time the stamp was put on it, your ass was on the line.
We started trying them 6 months in, you know, just kind of, where is this headed?
Yeah.
And we liked what we saw.
Okay.
So our first barrel finish release was a matured single malt whiskey followed by 2 years of barrel finish in X rum cast from Kill Devil Hills.
Hmm.
And it turned out fantastic. It's still very much our single malt whiskey, our Speyside style single malt whiskey. But we have a really nice orchard fruit profile in this whiskey.
From all the ester production, mm-hmm. all the esters in the rum, sure.
Exactly. But with that rum cask finish, we're like some of those green grass notes that and hay notes that you might get in our single malt whiskey.
Yeah.
A little more like green papaya.
Esterified a little bit, okay. Mm-hmm.
And instead of more of an orchard fruit profile, think like a pear, red apple skin, those elements.
Sure, sure.
Transitioned a little more into like a pineapple and mango direction. Really nice kind of transition that's subtle. And if you taste them side by side, it's really fun to see.
It's really apparent.
Right. Yeah. So it was a great opportunity for us to try something new. We've got a number of other things behind the curtain.
Well, I mean, top secret stuff, I guess.
Yeah, right.
But you guys also went into rye whiskey at one point. You had released some rye whiskey, which I was lucky enough to try some of that. It was phenomenal. And then I read on... Sadly, tears in my eyes as I'm using the internets to do research about Oak and Grist before you show up, said that that was the last release of rye?
It was, yeah. So this was made by William before I came on board.
Sure.
Our brew setup, we have ladder screens, traditionally doing single malt whiskey and only working with barley in
so rye is distillery. A whole nother Oscar, you bet.
He was able to will it into existence.
Oh, by his name alone. Yeah, sure.
Right. From what I understand, the laddering process was absolutely nightmarish, and we used all the rice hulls in North America to try and accomplish it.
So those that are listening, rye is just super high in beta-glucanase. It gelatinizes at a low temperature. Basically, in your louder ton, I'm assuming you made a big pot of Jell-O.
Yeah, I would liken it to 250 gallons of oatmeal and trying to get the liquid out of it.
Yeah, squeezing it through the oatmeal. Yeah, it would have been a huge pain in the, I apologize for language, fanny.
Yeah.
Yeah, big time.
I'm glad I wasn't there for it because I have made rye whiskey before and it wasn't very fun.
No, it's without some of the bioglucanase enzymes and some of the heat stable amylases and things that can help thin that out. And then with, you know, a lot of times that's done on grains. So you guys having kind of not necessarily the right setup to start.
We don't have the right equipment. I mean, I would say it'd be like trying to cook a Michelin star level steak on a camp stove.
Yeah.
You could technically do it.
With practice.
You're just going to suffer in the process.
You're going to there's going to be some loss. You might have to cut out the outside of it and just serve the center, but
So we split the release of those barrels into two releases. October of 22, we released half of that whiskey and then said, you know what, let's let it go. We sold it out in 10 days.
Yep.
And so let's keep people's, you know, palates a little like interested in this and mm-hmm. hold off on the rest of it. January of this year, we released the tail end of that rye whiskey and just sold our last bottle last week.
Nice.
So it is ostensibly done, allegedly done.
Allegedly.
But we were joking about it at the distillery a couple weeks ago and said, you know, it's kind of like that relationship you were in with somebody that was completely crazy years ago. And now you're looking back and saying, but it wasn't really that bad. You've got your rose colored glasses on when you're looking at sales.
Well, not only that, but like you get to taste the whiskey.
Yeah. And it was absolutely killer whiskey.
It was fantastic.
And so I think there's some interest in possibly doing it again, but that's going to be relying on expansion and new equipment. In order to make it worth the time. We're too busy to have a kind of goofy project that
you're going to have a production. Well, you're going to have a way to do that on the side so you can continue the machine that's already working.
Totally.
Honestly.
Yeah.
And it could be a one-off. It could be something else. It could be one of those things where it might work in a different scenario.
Right.
But right now it's just, you guys are pumping out so much juice. It's going to be hard to say, hey, we're going to tie this up for who knows how long.
Right.
Yeah. because this is what happened last time. Now we can be prepared for it, but it's still, yeah.
I already don't sleep. I can't sleep less.
So, and speaking of sleeping, I wanted to try to help you sleep.
Okay,
so this perfect. Is the segment. Now, you're a hard guy to find something that you haven't tried. Let's be honest. You've been drinking booze in moderation for a while. You were in wine. You're in spirits now. You went through the program here at AB Tech where you tried a lot of different beers and a lot of different spirits, wines, whiskey. I mean, I dug deep under the bar here to the back and dusted off a bottle today. And ironically enough, you had looked at the bottle and go, oh, yeah, I think I knew their first sales rep.
Yeah, I knew their first sales rep for Western North Carolina.
which is super funny. But this is a newer spirit from them. And so I kind of wanted to see what you thought of it. It's unusual to say the least, but I was honestly pleasantly surprised by it. I think I've tasted it on the podcast before, but it's so unusual. In the spirits industry, it is it's a liqueur that pours relatively thick in these small little tulip glasses that we have. I guess it would be like almost a mahogany color in the glass. Take a smell, take a sip, tell me what you smell and taste and feel, and then we'll talk about what it is because it is a little bit outside the box.
On the nose. Absolutely earthy, dark fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea of what it is already, but unmistakable, one of its primary ingredients, and a really nice kind of bouquet of roasty herbs.
Mm-hmm.
Savory herbs.
Yeah.
I could see this being a great accompaniment for a roast turkey. At the holidays.
Oh,
I mean, that's the first place I go.
Put a glaze with this on a turkey.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, I was thinking pork, just like a pork loin.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or go Midwestern. I know you're a Midwestern guy. Get some pork steaks on some direct heat.
Yeah, I love it.
You know,
chops. Chops on the grill there.
300 degrees for 3 to 4 hours. And a little mop sauce with this actually would be fantastic, especially in the cooler months and really bring out some of that warm, roasty, herbal presence.
The other thing I thought it would make would be an amazing vinaigrette.
Hands down. Yeah, absolutely.
Just an amazing vinaigrette. So what we're drinking is something called Beatnik from the kids over in Durham. The brothers, and I'm going to probably destroy his last name, and I apologize. Brother Vigalis Spirits Company out of Durham. We've been tasting their Krupnikas for a long time in class because it's just a honey-based Lithuanian, Eastern European, herbal-infused kind of elixir, and they've come up with one that has beets, orange zest, thyme, rosemary, sage, and fennel, and it's like this curious blend of savory herbs and a little bit of sweetness. I could see this with tonic just being kind of a cool, unique, refreshing, like aperitif, or even after dinner drink, or something that, you know, like you said, something with a roasted characteristic with this, with these herbal.
But honestly, even in the summer. You know, one of my go-tos for a long time, having a wine background, has been vermouth and vermouth spritzes in the summer. It's like you want something that packs an incredible amount of flavor and you want to really ratchet down that ABV so you can cruise on it.
So I've got another thing special that we got to drink because I'm pulling bottles out left and right here to get back at it because I've kind of got a hit.
Well, I see Malort up there and I... Oh yeah,
so this is a bottle from the 70s,
some vintage
chartreuse.
Yeah.
So
green, I will say for the listeners,
yes. And it's a drab green because it's been oxidized because it's so old, but I wished I had a fresh bottle because the way that these two drink side by side is so very different. And it just, some people like the characteristic as it ages and some people don't. But that being said, I think the complexity of this stuff with 130 botanicals can just mesmerize folks.
I have always had an affinity for alcohol that's old enough to buy itself.
Yeah.
No, I truly love deeply aged wines, and that's not the profile that most wine drinkers are going to care for. It's somebody that's either got a passion for it or has been in the industry and has really developed a palate in that direction. But even aging beers, which I know is probably something that you kind of look down upon a little bit.
But there are styles of beer that can increase in complexity and get better with age.
Yeah.
Just like there's handfuls of wine that get better with age.
I just had a couple of sours from Wicked Weed that hit 10 years and opened them recently.
Oh, I bet they were fantastic.
And absolutely beautiful. And that's kind of leaning in the wine direction of very high acid, fruited sours.
Yeah, but just like big giant Bordeaux's that need that time to let those tannins relax.
Right, yeah. It's just a different way of drinking something, and it doesn't mean that it's necessarily better, but if I'm aging beer, I'll buy three of them of the same thing.
Sure.
I'll drink one fresh. I'll drink one partly through an age.
Yeah.
And I'll drink one when it gets really old. And it's fun. For me, it's fun to see that transition of profile in the exact same product from the same producer, from the same production, and then really see how that changes and develops. And sometimes, I'll be honest, I've screwed it up. And it didn't turn out very well.
100%.
It's a shot in the dark.
I've aged some barley wines too long.
Yeah.
I have. And there's a time where the peak flavor was like everything was just melding together. And now some of them, they're kind of gone. But yeah, one of the things, Old Suffolk was this brewery in England that would take this beer and they would brew a high strength beer. And they would age it for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
Fooder style. Big beer, pretty much for the most part, clean fermentation. And then they blend it with this new amber that they make. So you get the Hannah Montana beer. You get the best of both worlds. You get these super aged, oxidative complexity with the leather-bound tones and mm-hmm. rich mahogany. And then you get these bright, beautiful hop flavors. It's just a very interesting beer because you have this...
It's kind of like Belgian Goose in a lot of ways.
100%.
It's like, let's take some fresh and, the sum is greater than the parts, right?
Yeah.
And it's like blending whiskey. And I mean, that's kind of how we oftentimes...
It's the dirty secret of all these industries. It's all about blends.
I give a lot of tours at work and people will ask how do you choose barrels? And I always tell them, barrel aging is, and everything for us is 53 gallon traditional US bourbon barrel size barrels. Nothing small. We're not doing any rapid aging techniques, no chips, staves, anything like that. I always tell them it's kind of a bell-shaped curve, and young isn't bad and old isn't necessarily good either.
Correct.
They just are different and they bring their own unique characteristics. So if we're blending to style, I need some fresh, youthfulness in that blend sometimes.
You want some of that older backbone to still come through and some of the mature flavors.
Of my spirit characteristic.
You worked hasn't hard
been
making
taken,
it.
Yeah, that hasn't been taken over by the barrel. And it's really finding, it's sort of putting a puzzle together in your mind.
Yep.
But the only way to see that puzzle is through your nose and your palate.
Right.
I think it's the hardest thing that we do. All of the brewing and the distillation at the end of the day is chemistry and math.
Physical labor.
A lot of physical labor, right. But you can learn to do that, and it's not terribly subjective. Now, it's different from distillery to distillery.
Sure.
You're going to have your own process and your own techniques. But once you learn that, it's replicable.
Well, when you learn the consistency, everything is more predictable coming off the still.
Right.
So now you've got this, but 50% of the matured spirit in a barrel is coming from that barrel.
Right. And I think
flavor wise,
that's where the artistry is coming in. And I find that to be the most laborious and mentally taxing thing that
It's got to be intimidating to just look at, all of those barrels and go, I've got to put this product together from those. And each one of those barrels is its own little microcosm of flavor.
Right. And the way that I do all the blending with William, and the way that I approach that is know everything we've ever made, what we currently have on hand, and where we want to go in the future.
Sure.
And so if you come in today and taste our single malt for the first time, our Speyside style, and say, you know what? I love this whiskey. That is my palate's profile. This is fantastic. And you're from out of town or you're busy with kids and you come back in a year or two or five, I want you to try that same whiskey, our Speyside style, and still love it and have it be in the same flavor profile lane. But as I have more and more barrels available for blending purposes, I want to show depth of maturation and character in there, but still have it be a recognizable product. So it is a, it's a real challenge.
No, well, and as you're selling more and as you're expanding how many barrels you have and how many, you know, it's the palette that you're painting with, right?
Yeah.
And as you get, and I always go back to the Bob Ross, right? You get your Thalo Blue and you're, you know, you've got a couple of palette of things to work for. Now, if you have the primary colors, you can paint all sorts of different colors. But now you've got all these like things in between and vermilion and like teal and all these other colors that you can paint this picture in a glass now. And that's, you know, I've liked the single malt stuff you've made from the beginning. Now, I think as, you know, anybody learns process, anybody has more stuff to paint with, anybody that has more time with their still, I think it's gotten even better. And it's just fantastic.
We've always made, in my opinion, good whiskey.
100%.
We're making better whiskey than we've ever made. We've learned a lot in the process.
Well, and that's anywhere. I mean, just the production, the efficiencies, all of the things. So this is a little bit older chartreuse than you've probably had before, or maybe you have, I don't know. But you get definitely some of that oxidative.
I mean, you say from the 70s?
Yeah. So you being someone that likes old wine, I'm a huge fan of fortified wines. I have
totally
a love of these oxidized sherries, Madeiras, Marsalas, certainly port.
If I have a nice dinner, if I go out to a really nice dinner, I don't want dessert after dinner. I want Madeira.
Thank you.
All day long. Give me a small pour of Madeira.
Yeah, like a pint glass of Madeira.
Right, yeah. You know, for $475.
Yeah, right. It's hard to track some of those down every now and again, but like I just absolutely love Madeira.
And the beauty of it is, I'll always tell people with Madeira specifically, go buy a really nice bottle if you like it.
Yeah.
It's already been Madeirized. It is already ruined in a traditional sense.
Yeah.
And so open it for your anniversary. You know, go buy a $100 bottle. That's not inexpensive, but and next year on your anniversary, have another pour.
And from that same bottle, and
it'll
fine.
Still be
yes.
fantastic.
Well, as long as you keep the cap on it.
Right.
Or the cork. Or
But you're as far as stretching your drink dollar, Madeira is one of the most fantastic ways to do it, and it's beautiful wine.
And I tell people, like, if you open a bottle of port, you're committed. Now, I'm not trying to tell people to really, you know, overconsume or anything, but, like, port will oxidize. You won't have those same flavors. Madeira goes through the estufaging process. It's already oxidized. You can pour yourself a finger or six every evening and enjoy it. And it is a treat. It is such a treat.
Yeah.
I want to go to that island at some point.
I would love it.
I think AB Tech should send me there.
Well, go as your chaperone.
As my my tour guide.
Yeah.
Not that I speak fluent Portuguese, but I'm willing to learn. What do you think of this chartreuse?
Very oxidized right off the bat. I mean,
the bottle's been open for a long time.
It's an open bottle from the 70s. This bottle of chartreuse is older than I am.
Well, I think it's either 70s or 80s, but it is older. I think it's, I wished I had, I can look it up, but it was given to me by the owner of Little Jumbo.
Okay.
And he was like, I'm not a fan.
It's Gray Shawl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Shawl Gray.
Shawl Gray. Shawl Gray.
I always and he was like, I'm not a fan. And I was like, well, I like chartreuse. And he goes, cheers. I go, seriously?
I mean, there's some really good, like, kind of candied lime peel elements in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's still freshness despite a heavy oxidative
this
character.
Spearmint and mint. And, like, it's just very, very interesting. And trying to track down a new bottle is hard because they're limiting production.
But right.
It's a treat. I think it's quite a treat.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. I know you'd appreciate it, especially after I gave you a beet liqueur, which I also think I didn't want to like that, but I really like it.
I mean, I could see that being, I keep coming back to Thanksgiving on it just because of some of the flavor profiles.
Yeah.
But if you're getting
that
up,
fall, that if, savory fall flavors, it's
if
just
you're, if you're cooking all day,
yeah,
you know, and you want to have a drink earlier, but you're also trying to make sure the food comes out correctly and you don't get in an argument with your family. having some of that beatnik with some seltzer in there.
Oh, a club soda. Just a very effervescent, like savory.
You're going to bring a massive flavor punch, and you're probably going to work that down to 3.5 to 5% alcohol if you put 6 ounces of seltzer in there, and you're not going to be wanting for flavor at all.
No.
So it's a really good kind of like early day cruiser. I could see that being a really fun one for a tailgate for a football game in like October.
It's cool weather. Cold breeze. And then you've got like things like brats and stuff coming off the grill.
Just all day long.
Yeah. So it would help cut through some of the fat. I mean, it's just it was given to me by a student that's about to graduate, and he's like, I don't know what to do with this, but I really like it. And I go, well, let's try it. And we did. And I was like, I like beets though. So if you don't like beets, you don't like that earthy beet flavor, you're not going to like this, but I really liked it. And I'm even a huge sage person, but that like the balance of the botanicals in here is really quite well done.
I would say this is just the sales background I have in
mind. Oh, here we go.
While I think that it's actually really interesting and delicious to drink, I would find it a nightmare to have in my book, especially if I represented that distillery specifically. And not that there's nothing wrong with the spirit. It would just be that I would have to give a dissertation to every single person
every
I tasted
you're trying
that
to sell
on.
It.
Yeah, it would be a lot of work. Now, I think it would be like a fun challenge.
100%.
But I'd want some other things in my book to support my paycheck.
And that's, well, and they have a bunch of other things in their book, which is nice because some of the other Krupnikas that they make is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And I find it very soothing for a sore throat.
Yeah. And honestly, depending on where you were in the country too, if you had more of a Central or Eastern European diaspora, I think that you could really probably sell that more effectively.
I think that's why I would sell here in Asheville.
Yeah.
With the Eastern European population that we have here. I think that, you know, like if you're making a thing of borscht. You just nailed it with that, right?
Totally.
It'd be just like a little sweetener in that soup, right?
Yep.
So what's new? What's next? What's on the horizon for Oak and Grist?
A couple of exciting things. One, we hired a full-time salesperson. So I'm still kind of involved.
You're still doing sales.
I'm still kind of involved a little bit. I kind of prefer to never not be involved. It's something that I'm good at and have enjoyed. But hiring a full-time salesperson for us was kind of a big move.
Yeah.
Getting to that point and really looking to grow beyond being a zip code distillery. And we're across the state in the ABC system, and we have orders all the way from Wilmington to Western North Carolina. But really growing our presence, and it flat out came to the point where it's like, I don't have time to run 50 plus hours of production a week or 6 days a week, which isn't uncommon, and do sales at the same time and to do it efficaciously, so that's a big get for us. Spencer's a fantastic guy. And he has been absolutely crushing it. So it's been one of those things that, you know, you hire somebody to do this and you have the background. He hasn't worked in alcohol sales before, but he used to teach fermentation at Five Seasons here in town. So he would do weekend classes, kind of a side hustle for him. He's a longtime home brewer, raises bees and makes his own mead, and has been doing that for a very long time. So he has a deeper understanding of
and
this industry.
Honestly. Yeah.
But he had been in sales in a very different direction for many years. And you're always kind of nervous when you bring somebody on to do something that you have experience doing, and you're going to turn some stuff over. And he is he's hungry.
Given that control is hard.
And he's killing it. And,
yeah, good.
And honestly, I got to say this, he's a really nice guy. which is kind of cool.
honestly, that makes a good working environment as well.
Yeah.
So now you're going to have to keep up with what he's trying to sell.
Well, that's been a secondary conversation.
Slow down, kid.
It was actually one of those things where we're like, all right, well, this is going much better than we expected right off the bat. So cool. I am happy to do more work on the production side to feed this machine. You know, I'm bought and paid for on this deal. Like I love what I do and who I work for. And I just, my one goal is to CSB as successful as possible. And so if that just means that production has more pressure on it, fantastic.
So be it. Yeah.
That is the right problem to have.
100%.
So we've got our core spirits. We've got our Geneva inspired gin. It's a white gin.
Yep.
Really fantastic. We've got a barrel aged variation of that.
So same gin, you just lay it down in a same single gin. Malt barrel?
Yep. So barrels that had previously held our whiskeys is what we always do. Because okay. we're using a couple of types of cooperage. We use both new and ex-bourbon cooperage for single malt production. So sure. all of our Speyside style single malt whiskeys are aged in ex-bourbon barrels.
Okay.
We also have an American malt whiskey, which is single malt whiskey as well. That's all being aged in new American oak. So a little more of a bourbon profile.
What's
to
the char level of that? Will you tell me?
Yes, we use 2 and 4 char barrels.
Okay.
A lot of folks use 3.
Yeah.
3 is pretty common in bourbon production.
Big time, yeah.
For us being a smaller volume distillery, choosing 2 and 4 gave us a little more blending
certainly.
Ability.
Yeah.
You know, so
that 2 is going to have a little unique, I mean, not everyone's going to be able to get that same flavor profile without having
right.
a 2.
Right, so it just provided flexibility for us
yeah.
When it came to blending and releasing things. So that's our barrel reserve gin. I've got some here with me. It's a year and 156 days in barrel. So
wow.
really beautiful, like barrel aged gin is a non-defined category by the TTB.
I mean,
it could be 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months. For us, it's about profile.
Yep. You bottle it for flavor, right?
Yeah, we're bottling for flavor. And we've been doing it for years. It's now a core product. It originally started out as a once a year release. Then it was a twice a year spring, fall. But it's become so popular that we really started laying a lot of barrels down to feed this machine. But a really beautiful kind of light amber color on that.
It is pretty.
And you'll notice.
It is very pretty.
Don't be shy, Jeff.
I normally don't. Oh, here, I'll get some new glasses. You okay. keep talking.
You'll notice the kind of herbal tea-like profile of our Geneva-style gin really transform into more of a fruit and floral-driven profile.
You notice how the glasses keep getting bigger?
Yeah, they are growing substantially.
These tiny little tasting glasses, and then they went into some bigger snifters, and now your stuff comes out, and I've got like a, I don't know, this is a pretty big tulip-shaped glass here.
Do you want to make some Borgs with these? But we don't use any color additions in any of our products.
No caramel spirits to adjust color?
Not at all. And we don't use any flavor additives either. We don't
use any vanilla. Holy beans.
We don't use any enzymes in our brewing process. It is
wow.
When you taste our products, it is literally just barley, water, yeast, thyme, and wood.
Holy shit. That is fantastic. What a nose.
It's pretty crazy.
And in this glass in particular, I think I picked, like, just smell those two glasses side by side and the juxtaposition of, like, where the the schmells come. What a neat, wow.
And I'll tell you, if you enjoy whiskey cocktails, but maybe in the summertime they're a little on the boozier side or the heavier side, this will make a lights out gin old fashioned.
That's so good. I bet that makes an amazing Negroni too.
That is our house style of Negroni. Is we'll make it with our regular gin and it's delicious. Oh, there's Campari. Speak of the devil. But yeah, the barrel aged gin with a Negroni build.
I want that fantastic. Like almost like a rusty nail too.
Very good with a rusty nail.
A Drambuie. And mm-hmm. Wow. What an amazing smell. Oh, there's a softness to the nose too. It's like you said, the juniper is what it is. It's mm-hmm. it's more reserved in this gin. Now that it's aged, some of that juniper flavor has actually kind of been even muted more. And there's just this, there's a sweetness, but it doesn't, it's not cloying by any stretch of the mm-hmm. imagination. There's a sweetness up front, and then it's so crisp and clean. It's very palate refreshing.
And there's some baking spice elements in there. There's some nutmeg. There's some dark fruit. But I always get like honeysuckle and cherry blossom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's these really pretty delicate floral elements that are in there. My experience with a lot of barrel aged gin is people don't leave it in barrel for very long and it kind of comes out woody.
That's
it's just immature. It hasn't reached its maturation in the barrel for it to really find its like homeostatic balance.
Yeah. I don't like woody gin.
I don't either.
I don't like that tannicky punch in the face.
Mm-hmm.
This is really well balanced. Yeah. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, it's a fun one for sure.
There's a lot. Yeah, you could do a lot of variations on this one.
Mm. We've got, like I said, our American malt whiskey aged in all new American oak barrels, 2 and 4 char levels.
I know that the cost of new oak has gone through the roof.
You don't say.
Yeah, I know that you know. Do you think, looking forward, and I know that there's specific categories for used spirits, like mm-hmm. used oak to be, you know, it's like whiskey distilled from a rye mash or whiskey distilled from a wheat mash, and they can use used oak barrels in right. that case. Do you think with the cost of barrels, with the amount of things you're seeing, and with specifically younger palates looking for this a little bit, I think, more balance. I mean, they're not drinking these big, giant, you know, overproof bourbons and things like that.
I think that's an older drinking crowd that had
been old.
And I'm probably older than a lot of those people too. And I'm just saying, I think that's more of a folks that are in their 40s, 50s, 60s.
Banana nut too. This mm-hmm. is fantastic.
Like a banana nut bread yes. almost.
Yes. It reminds me of the banana muffins my wife makes. Mm. Man, that's just classic. It almost reminds me of sati, the drink, you know, from that juniper region where they put it through these juniper fronds, and there's juniper berries in the beer. Man, this is fantastic.
Thank you.
Just fantastic. Yeah, Will does good work.
He does.
I'm just messing with. Ooh.
So yeah, barrels are substantially more expensive than they were. I think that
than even 5 years ago. Well, wow, I just housed that gin. Wow.
And partly that's pressure on timber.
It is.
Partly there's not a lot of coopers left in the United States.
That's the other thing. There's not a lot of people doing it.
And there's an incredible expansion in barrel aging spirits in India and China. And the amount of pressure that's coming from the export market to buy barrels out of the United States, whether they're used bourbon barrels or they're new.
Yeah.
We recently had somebody come in the distillery who works in that export market and was just like, I'll buy anything you have. And I was like, I don't really have much that's empty right now. And because I don't, and our costs are way up, I'm going to sell it to you if I do at a price that's not going to be very attractive because yeah. I need to be able to buy 2x of what I'm selling
To recoup this. Yeah. So I was contacted via email by somebody local that was looking for 1,000 barrels to export.
Yeah.
Today. And I mean, if I could track those barrels down, you're going to have to go through a broker. And like you said, the price is going through the roof.
And us being a single malt distillery, once our new barrels have been dumped, they're just getting pushed back into Speyside style single malt production.
Sure.
So we really are, you know, we will at a certain point find, you know, our 4 or 5 or 6 dumps where we're losing too much profile. Barrels.
Sure.
You know, and maybe then that final fill is something that we say, all right, well, we're not going to mess with this for 15 years. You know, because we really need, sure. you know, we need more time for flavor extraction and sure. we can still achieve it, but it's on a much longer time scale that point.
It's also blending stock at that point, right?
Right.
So there's no reason to, I don't want to say there's no reason to get rid of that barrel, but there is a secondary use sale market.
Totally.
With the collaboration that's happening in wine and beer and cider, there's definitely that secondary market for those barrels as well, where you're looking at all of these people, you know, talking about aging. I think there's cider in that barrel would be,
oh yeah,
really, really neat.
We've thought of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think,
but we get a lot of calls from people that want to age coffee beans, that want to age maple syrup,
honey,
that want to age honey.
Yeah.
And they, because they're not dealing with cooperage in any scale, they're just looking for single or barrels or maybe 2 barrels.
Yep.
They're not finding them anywhere because no one is giving them up.
No,
at all.
No one wants to. And I have seen a local distillery, give a barrel for honey.
Mm-hmm.
Then they got the barrel back and they rested some
yeah, I'm familiar with that. Some
product yep. in there, and they couldn't get all the honey out of the barrel because there's no really safe way to heat up a wooden barrel. Right. And so there was just crystallized honey throughout the barrel, and they filled it back full of liquor, and now they have this liqueur that That also turned out.
And again, for them, what a great opportunity to create a one-off product, and they're not blowing up their production to do it. It's not re-engineering anything.
No.
And to cross market with another business, especially if it's a local business that was doing that honey, you know, it's like give them
a local business.
Give them some love, you know, and 100%. Like, you know, my philosophy really is in this industry. It's like rising tide lifts all ships. Like,
yeah,
sure, we all have proprietary secrets. No doubt we're individual businesses, but let's be in it for the betterment of all of us. Because if, especially in distillation, as craft distillation, it is a much smaller industry, though growing rapidly, than craft beer is. And so it is harder to collaborate between distilleries.
It is. And it seems to me, because of there are some proprietary things on the distillation side, and there's people trying to learn. The thing about brewing is you can practice at home.
Right.
You really aren't, by federal law, you aren't supposed to distill at home. So it's not something that you can practice. You got to come to AB Tech and you know, distill here and apply that trade. And so while I see there are distilleries, kind of micro distilleries popping up all over the place, it's a hard business. Because it's not about just making the juice. It's about selling it, as you've said before. And it's, you know, the marketplace and the shelf space is more difficult to obtain.
Sure.
Because of, you know, we'll go out and buy a six-pack of beer, and it's, I don't view it as an investment.
No.
If I go buy a barrel-reserved Genever-inspired gin, it's not something, you know, I would drink over a weekend, or I shouldn't.
Right.
I mean, this one I might, but
that's up to you.
That's a whole nother story.
But
I mean, with friends, like a team of people, I wouldn't do it by myself. Yeah, and as far as you know,
financially, the distillation side is so much harder.
Even
if you're going to flip spirits that have been, you know, you're buying from MGP and you're essentially
even grain neutral spirits. Right. Yeah, like a vodka is a hard market because there's so many on the and they all have a story and they all have.
But, you know, if I start a brewery for $150,000, a small one.
Yep.
But you could get off the ground for $150,000, maybe slightly more.
I would say maybe $250,000. Get that 10-barrel brew house. You get it used. You find a place.
Right.
Lease is okay.
That's a lot of money, objectively.
100%.
But that pales in comparison to starting a distillery. And if I can, from mashing in to pulling a tap handle, be 15 to 21 days,
you could maybe even doing a half of ice, you could do it in 5 days, right?
So, you know, I'm able to get a return very quickly on those dollars. 100%. So cash flow management looks very different
much
than a distillery.
Better. No, and I always say the equipment for a brewery, depending on the type of distillery you're setting up, is way more expensive up front. But say you're buying a still and you're buying a mash cooker or whatever, and you're doing stuff on grains, it's cheaper, but to get the money back, if you start talking about laying those barrels down and you have to mature this stuff, the investment in a distillery is maybe five times more than what would it be for a brewery at that point.
And I was not born a patient man.
That's hard thing about distillation.
And I exist in a bifurcated world which it's like I have to work very hard every day to lay things down, and then at the same time be exceedingly patient for them to reach maturity. And so I will say, from a therapeutic standpoint, it's actually been a very healthy experience in my life.
It's your therapy now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, find the benefits in everything that you can.
I love it.
But it is a weird thing. There's no, let's flip this quickly and we can get this in kegs or in cans or.
And it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, not on the distillation side of things, not on the wine side of things. When you're talking about seasonal production kind of stuff too, it's very, very different.
And people try it. And when you taste it, you know.
100%.
You know that it was a rush job. And sometimes there's not a choice for small businesses. As they're getting off the ground, they've got to release things that are immature because they've got to make money. But it's a dangerous proposition to do that because if that, you know, if you taste it one time and say it's just not there,
you've got basically one chance at that consumer.
Right.
And again, I view spirits more as an investment.
Totally.
And then something like beer or wine, something that's consumed.
Yeah.
Because that bottle is going to take a shelf space in my house. And it could be there for a while, right?
Yeah, you could work a six-pack of craft beer out of your fridge pretty quickly.
Yeah, between me and my wife, I'd have one, she'd have five. Mm.
That you're a generous
man. She never listens to this, so it's okay.
blink twice if you need help.
Blink, blink. Wait, you're not supposed to say that out loud. No, she's way better than I deserve. So when you talk about, you've always had a passion for this stuff. Where do you think it came from? Because your passion's coming in the glass. I can feel it. I can understand the flavors that you're talking about. And when you're saying, like, this is what we do, it's over 100 days, it's not woody because everything has had a chance to reach basically homeostasis. We don't have all these tannins. Some of have, you know, gone back into where there's going to be a balance. It's not something that's a short scene. And so when we look at the flavor profiles of some of the stuff you're talking about, where does it come from? Where do you think your passion for this stuff has come from?
Well, when I was 18, allegedly, found out I enjoy drinking alcohol.
Overseas in Europe.
Right, of course, yeah.
Because no one would ever consume this stuff before they're 21 in the United States.
Certainly not. But it was just a fun thing, right? Like a college thing, you know, like everybody's drinking, right? And I didn't think much of it. And it was like, what's my per ounce cost? I was doing math on everything. What's the cheapest? You know, like I was an economist of those things. But yeah. Fast forward a couple of years, in my early 20s, I was looking for a new job. I had a college buddy that played basketball with somebody that owned a wine wholesaler here in Asheville. And we were having some beers after a game. And he said he was looking to hire a new driver. I said, I'm looking for a new job. And he said, okay, cool. Can you drive a truck? And I said, not a tractor trailer, but up to 26,000 pounds. I'm comfortable. And he said, do you have a DUI? And I said, no. And I said, okay, come in on Monday. And that was my job interview. And so I started driving a truck 3 days a week from Asheville to Charleston, South Carolina. I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, drive to the warehouse, load the truck, drive to Charleston, work a 9-hour day delivering wine, drive home that night, and I do that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday every single week.
Holy shit.
And that lasted about 6 months because it sucked.
That drive is tough.
Yeah, they're really long days.
It's even worse now, but yeah, it had to have been terrible.
And I don't know if you know this, but Charleston is very hot in the summer, and that's when I started doing this. So it was like bring 3 t-shirts every day.
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up with a wine culture at all in my home. My mom would have a glass of wine with dinner, but you know, like it wasn't a big thing.
No.
And my father actually doesn't drink at all. So they started giving me free samples. They wanted me to learn about things. And at first it was fun. I was like, all right, well, I'm getting free juice.
Yeah.
But I very quickly realized it was agriculture. It was geology. It was geography. It was, food culture, which I grew up in a pretty big food family.
Yep.
But it was conquering. It was war. It was peace. It was human migration. All of these things, you know, like Vitis vinifera came from Central Asia, like the Republic of Georgia, essentially now.
Yeah.
And
the
yet
birthplace of all wine.
It followed human expansion across the world. And I just fell in love with it. It was an endless source of research. And I just have a mind that wants to learn and learn and learn. And so it was like, I could try something and be like, I've never heard of this wine. Okay, well, it's from this place. What do people eat in this place? I love to cook. Let's cook a recipe from there to enjoy it with the wine. Okay, now they're both better. You know, and it was this real eye-opening experience. And ultimately, I came to realize that, you know, for me, I was put on this earth to work with alcohol. And not because I want to overconsume it, because I'm just passionate about it. And there are very few things that throughout human history, we collectively as a species have done. We stare at the sky and the stars and wonder what exists beyond us. We make stories about it. We make our own creation stories of how we came to be who we are. We've been driven to make art. Look at cave paintings dating back 100,000 years to art being created in the River Arts District right now today, as we speak. And we figured out 10,000 years ago how to ferment every single sugar source on the face of this planet.
It's amazing.
And consume it.
Yeah.
And it turned out life was very, very difficult back then. It's hard enough now. It was way harder back in those
days.
Way
harder.
And if you drank some of that fermented thing, it made you feel a little bit better. And so I just, to me, it is like, I view my piece of alcohol production as like maybe the truest way I could be connected to human lineage throughout time. I didn't invent any of it. No one will remember when I die that I did what I did after a generation or so. I am just a steward in the process of this. And so I was lucky enough to be brought into it and learn from people. And I'd like to provide an educational experience to other people and an opportunity for them to enjoy it. So we continue this whole cycle.
Absolutely prolific. Thank you, Mr. Stanley. Thank you to Oak and Grist. Thank you to everyone listening, because I'm not going to be able to top anything you've ever said. Pretty much the end of the podcast right here. Thanks for everyone for listening, learning, and laughing with me on Consuming the Craft podcast. Cheers, everybody.